I'm Christopher Ludden with the Indian-born writer Pankaj Mishra. He's a modern patrolman along the ever-evolving lines between East and West. Pankaj Mishra, you've written an arresting book, literally a stop-and-think sort of book about the roots of the East-West tension. You're centered on Chinese and Islamic and Indian intellectuals who founded anti-colonial thinking, in a sense, at a time when the British and other European empires were running rampant. We're talking about the forefathers of Gandhi and Ho Chi Minh and Nasser, and you make it feel like a story for today. In this book, From the Ruins of Empire, I'm hearing a kind of wake-up call about angry Asia from an alarm clock that, in fact, has been ringing for more than a century. But suddenly we hear it, and we read your book in the context of recent news, including Benghazi and the recent UN meetings where President Morsi of Egypt said it's time for a new relationship. You end up your book saying that the spell of Western power has finally been broken. But I wonder.
Thank you, Chris. I think the basic attempt that all of these people that I describe in my book, whether from China, or whether from Egypt or Turkey, Iran or India, their basic attempt was to regain dignity in a world that had been dominated for far too long by a small minority of Europeans, white men mostly, who actually belonged to very, very small societies on one corner of Europe. We were talking about Western Europe, and had spread around the world, had conquered these vast continents, and had imposed their ways upon native populations when the native populations actually survived their conquest, which was often rare, as we know. So this particular attempt, which really defines the 20th century for most Asians, their attempts to regain the dignity they had enjoyed before the Europeans arrived in their respective societies, that has been the central event for a vast majority of the world's population. But, that's something that a lot of people in Europe and America missed, because they were involved in other battles. They were involved in their own battles, first of all, and then they were involved in this long standoff with the Soviet Union, with communism in general. But you can trace this awakening, this political awakening that we are witnessing in the Arab world, in other parts of Asia. We see that in Turkey, we see that in China. You can trace it all back to that moment in the late 19th century, when the first generation of writers and intellectuals and leaders began to outline what their societies needed to do if they wanted to survive, if they did not want to be subjugated and humiliated by these sort of upstart Europeans. And that process, which has manifested itself in anti-colonial movements, in mass political movements, in state-building programs, whether in China or India, and we see one manifestation of that in the Arab Spring, which has just experienced a form of delayed decolonization, where people who were denied sovereignty and self-determination for a very long time have now finally broken through and ended this unnaturally prolonged Western domination over their countries.
I guess the big puzzle for me is why Americans don't hear the call with broader sympathy. And I don't mean just, loving strange people, but I mean with more identification of our own anti-imperial roots in the 18th century, the American Revolution, and that sort of thing. Why it's so hard for the West to get the message on time?
I think particularly in America, it's been harder because, in places like France and Britain, which had to fight extremely bloody, extremely violent insurgencies in places like Algeria, the Malay Peninsula. I mean, getting out of India was a relatively painless affair for the British. Of course, it was extremely painful and costly for millions of people who were displaced in India and Pakistan. But, with all those experiences, many Western European countries, including the Dutch, who were kicked out of Indonesia, they knew that, you know, this awakening, this intellectual awakening of Asia was very, very important, and that was irreversible. Many, many people in Britain, which, you know, and I include politicians and historians and the intelligentsia in general, realized that. But somehow that message never got through, partly because the United States emerged at the end of the Second World War as the most powerful nation on earth, while everyone else lay devastated across Asia, across Europe. America was coming into a very exalted, was embracing a very exalted idea of its power and its moral mission. You know, it was involved in the reconstruction of post-war Europe very deeply, as we know. It was involved in the reconstruction of Japan. So there was this notion of custodianship, of, you know, being the leader of the free world, all, and of course, in a more exaggerated form, ideas about the American century, that this was now going to be the American century. And all of these ideas coincided, strangely enough, with this unstoppable momentum of decolonization. So at the same time that the Americans were coming into this, you know, this sort of these assumptions of global leadership, you had peoples all across Asia and Africa basically striving for self-determination.
But meantime, I should note, though, that Franklin Roosevelt, during World War II, for all his incredible closeness to Winston Churchill, encouraged Indian independence, and he would never promise Churchill that we would be part of any effort to hold India. And similarly in Vietnam, I've forgotten the details, but there was a written connection with Ho Chi Minh that the French would be out at the end of the war, and the United States wouldn't think of imposing something like that on them again. So there was a last opportunity, in a way.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the problem is that FDR did not live long enough to witness the Cold War and to experience the imperatives of the Cold War and the imperatives to fight Soviet communism, to contain Soviet communism, which forced one American president after another to, you know, support what FDR would have completely rejected, you know, the policies of supporting France, for instance, against Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam, the Anglo-American coup against the elected Prime Minister of Iran, Mossadegh, in 1953. All of these things seemed very, very important suddenly to American policymakers, which made them assume the responsibility, thankless tasks of European empires in Southeast Asia and the Middle East, because the you know, they were faced with this perceived threat of monolithic communism. So whether in Iran or Vietnam, the older kind of anti-imperial instincts of many American policymakers at that time were suppressed by this imperative to fight Soviet communism in various battlefields. So one reason why decolonization, the idea of decolonization, did not make a huge impact upon the American geopolitical imagination is because, you know, they were obsessed with this that threat of Soviet communism.
You're preaching, Pankaj Mishra, from an anti-imperialist text here at a very interesting moment, it seems to me, in the American thinking and experience of all of these issues, including, you know, Mitt Romney's stance of no apology to the world. In his own party, we had the fascinating exercise of Ron Paul to say, we don't belong anywhere out there. Come home, America, which was George McGovern's losing slogan, you know, 40 years ago. But it's a fascinating time, especially after the Arab Spring, just how the United States will respond, is responding, is thinking about the issues you're raising at the Arab Spring raises. What do you make of this context of the time in America for your book and for all the meetings you're having in this country these days?
Well, it's a very interesting moment, as you say, because I think you know, the older kind of neocon fantasy about reshaping the world with American power, actually American firepower, the limits of that have been completely exposed by the disastrous wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you know, the United States and its allies are looking for face-saving deals. So it's very clear that American firepower cannot shape political outcomes in these two countries, and indeed in any other part of the Middle East, or indeed Southeast Asia. So along with that recognition, you know, there will be inevitably people like Mitt Romney again reasserting the need for American, you know, supremacy, and all this talk about no apology, and we can still impose our will, and we can still make people do what we want them to do. But I think there is a you know, a realization creeping in that we have reached the limits of both firepower and diplomacy in these countries, that we have been discredited in the eyes of a large majority of the population in Muslim countries, who simply don't believe us when we talk about democracy and we talk about human rights. So I think it also, this realization is helped by the fact that the United States is going through, you know, one of the most severe economic crises in its recent history. And that, you know, brings with it the realization that we actually don't have the resources to force people to do what we want them to do in remote corners of the world, that we'd be better off nation building here internally, domestically, rather than doing it in places like Afghanistan. So I think and that's too partly reflected in response to this book, where people are confronted with how, you know, people in the Muslim world or India and China have seen the last 150 years that this is not at all like how Americans or Western Europeans have seen the same history, that we do inhabit different universes altogether.
There's a convergence of factors here, as you say. I mean, the embarrassment of the military adventure in Afghanistan, before that in Iraq, but also the severe economic distress in the Western economies, including ours, but also the, you know, the erosion or the offense to the idea of rule of law in the way the United States went into Iraq adds to the burden. And then there's also a kind of cultural thrust or blunting of the Western and American cultural thrust in the world. Take these things apart a little bit, if you will. I mean, what is the relationship of sort of the moral leadership to military power, to cultural energy, to economic, you know, we're still the source of big loans to places like Egypt and Mr. Morsi today. But what are the connections, do you think, between these strands?
I think, you know, American loans to a country like Egypt, which were predicated on Egypt being a loyal and pliant ally in the region, and essentially signing off on most of what Israel does, for instance, in that part of the world, and keeping Gaza more or less, you know, as an open air prison. I think those kinds of commitments made to Egypt, long term commitments, are now going to collide with the Egyptian search for dignity in that region and Egypt's search for a older leadership role in that region. One has to remember, during Nasser's time, that was a point of pride. He had restored a sense of pride and dignity to the nation by making it the leader of the Arab world. And Egypt is again striving for that role. And Iran has been doing that for some time now. So I think, you know, all of these previous alliances with the United States and various deals will now be under pressure from these new promises and commitments that the Egyptian leadership is now making to its own people, and having to accommodate the aspirations and longings of its own people. Morsi was very clear about this in the interview he gave to the New York Times just now. The people are paramount. Wasn't it fascinating? I mean, he was being very blunt that we simply cannot do what the United States tells us to do. We are now accountable to the people. And the people, he was too polite to say, are deeply distrustful of the United States, its role in the country's politics. The fact that until the very last moment, Hillary Clinton was claiming Hosni Mubarak as a family friend. people in Egypt don't forget this, and they haven't forgotten the way in which the Mubaraks were being propped up and their rule, their brutality was being justified by successive American administrations. So I think, you know, so much of what we saw or so much of what was being projected as American soft power and American military firepower has lost its potency in that world. And, you know, one has to remember that so much of that decline of soft power has also coincided with the emergence of different kinds of Arab media, whether it's Al Jazeera, whether it's satellite television, whether it's televangelism, which is a huge phenomenon in large parts of the Arab world. So they have their own sources of moral and cultural authority. And the shaping of political imaginations that happens in those particular cultures, you know, that is, again, a process over which the American media has no control whatsoever.
What's manageable and what's dangerous in this change, and really significant change in relationships? Among other things, I'm thinking of the predicament that this puts Israel in as a 51st state and a, you know, major ally of the United States.
Well, at this point, I mean, Israel has become a liability, to put it very bluntly, to the United States in that region, because, you know, most people in that part of the world see it as the only active colonialist project in that part of the world. And, you know, with their memories of Western colonialism, it's very easy for them to associate Israel, which, of course, as we know, was built on an entirely different basis altogether. But they associate Israel with their Western colonialist project. And I think for the United States to be so intimately identified with it, to be associated with it, is, you know, politically extremely dangerous. And, you know, I think in the next few years, we are going to see a collision between American geopolitical interests, especially if they remain aligned with that of Israeli interests. And indeed, as I said, the aspiration for dignity and self-determination amongst people in that part of the world.
And still, the American commitment to Israel is, across the political spectrum in this country, unbreakable, maybe even unchangeable.
Well, this is a problem, unfortunately, people in this country will have to sort out, because this, you know, as we know, this really wasn't the case even 20 years ago, when people like James Baker were pressing down very hard upon the Israeli elite to stop settlement building and were threatening to withdraw some of their aid, annual aid to Israel, if it didn't stop doing that. And I think there's been a weakening of political will in this country, and it needn't be like that. I mean, you know, there are ways in which the United States could influence the behavior of people like Netanyahu, who are, as we speak, running wild with their threats and with their sort of apocalyptic fantasies.
President Obama has tried. He hasn't found the handle yet.
No, and you know, this is really extraordinary. I mean, and what do you think people in other parts of the world see when they watch this spectacle of the Israeli Prime Minister upbraiding President Obama publicly, when they see him blatantly manipulating American politics? They see something very, very, very unhealthy for the United States, for the United States itself. So it's really a bizarre phenomena. And I mean, I don't know how we came to this pass, but this is really a problem that has to be sorted out very quickly.
Draw a moral, Pankaj Mishra, from the wise men that you're writing about and apply it to the so-called pivot toward Asia. Does even the word pivot make sense in this context? Is there a good way to pivot? Is there a wrong way to pivot?
If you're talking about the pivot to Asia, one has to remember that the previous intervention in Asia, in that part of the world, wasn't at all a successful one. It was a pretty disastrous one. So let's Vietnam, and not to mention what happened in Cambodia subsequently. So let's remember those lessons. Let's absorb them and not overplay our hand. The fact is that most of China's neighbors, although extremely wary of China's rise, are also not in a position to antagonize China, and that whatever the Americans do in that part of the world, they'll have to take on board that there is now a major power in the form of China, very much present in the lives of Southeast Asians, hundreds of millions of people, and that this is the interdependent relationship that no outsider can really break, and that the idea that countries like Indonesia or Vietnam would ally themselves with the United States in some sort of informal alliance against China. Again, this reeks Cold War thinking of outdated, you know, notions of international politics. They really have no place in this new world coming into being.
There are people in American policymaking who would happily make a much deeper, tighter alliance with India, even militarily, to be the democratic voice in a new Asia. What do you make of that impulse?
Again, it's an impulse very much fed by a certain kind of Cold War thinking. You know, let's have a strategic alliance with India in order to contain China in Asia. And, you know, India is obviously a natural ally because it's also democracy. Again, you know, you have big words like democracy, big abstractions like strategic alliance, obscuring certain realities. Let's leave aside the question of, you know, to what extent India is a democracy. Let's look at how independent-minded India has been in recent history in its international relations, and that there's no way the Indian political elites, there are parts of it, of course, very sympathetic to the United States, very much wanting to be part of a US-dominated world order. But there are also many people in India, very influential people, who do not really want to be part of a US-dominated world order, who see a different future for themselves in this new Asia coming into being, who want to develop, you know, normal relations with China and with its neighbors. So I think, again, a fantasy originating in Washington, D.C., amongst the, you know, well-funded think tanks and the sort of bureaucrats of State Department, that fantasy is not necessarily going to find any traction in the real world.
It seems to me, Pankaj Mishra, that your book, From the Ruins of Empire, is trying somehow to ease readers into a kind of more relaxed retreat from an overextended empire. I wonder, in the longer history of the 20th century, whether there's a British example here.
Well, it can't be, unfortunately, because the British retreat was not particularly graceful from places like India, from Palestine, from the Malay Peninsula. And also, one has to remember, the British retreat was caused largely by the losses suffered during the Second World War by Britain. Britain simply wasn't in a position to hold on to its vast imperial holdings, possessions, after the end of the Second World War. So the retreat was inevitable at that time, and one can only hope there won't be another war like that to force a similar American retreat from the world. So I don't really think there are any models for a graceful retreat, whether you look at France or whether you look at a smaller empire like Holland and Indonesia. I think what may happen is that, you know, America simply doesn't have the kind of financial clout empires need.
Could we just note, Pankaj Mishra, that we speak on the day that Eric Hobsbawm, magnificent British historian, died, an anti-imperialist, historian of the Age of Empires, among other things. He died at 95 in London. I want to try on you a note that he contributed in a late last little book called On Empire, America, War, and Global Supremacy. And he thought maybe the United States could learn something from the British experience. He said, Britain knew its limits, and especially the limits, present and future, of its military power. Being a middleweight country, which knew that it could not hold the world heavyweight championship forever, it was saved from the megalomania that is the occupational disease of would-be world conquerors. It occupied and ruled a larger part of the globe and its population than any state had ever done or is likely to do. But it knew it did not and could not rule the world, and it did not try.
I think that's actually right, in the sense that it was always hemmed in slightly by other empires, whereas I think the United States, particularly after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, and I think this post-Cold War, end of Cold War era, post-Berlin Wall period, has been one where the most destructive and fantasies have really flourished about full spectrum dominance. The most foolish ideas have got traction amongst serious policymakers, where a kind of document, new imperialist document that would have been laughed out of any British meeting in the late 19th century or early 20th century, that became almost a kind of official policy during the Bush administration. So that's really, I think, what Hobsbawm is talking about, is that, you know, certain forms of fantasy, which were never entertained by the British simply because they were hemmed in, there were other empires to compete with, and also they were seriously invested in the maintenance of their empire, that those kinds of limits the United States never actually experienced. So it could indulge, for some time at least, in these totally absurd fantasies until it collided with reality in places like Iraq and Afghanistan.
The neoconservative fantasy, however, is not quite dead either in American politics or American commentary. I mean, can you imagine an American president, even an American newspaper, taking a stand on Hobsbawm's premise that we cannot and shouldn't even want to try to rule the world?
For people accustomed to imposing their will upon the world and, you know, using a particular kind of language in which the United States is the prime mover of events and is invariably well-intentioned in doing that, this is the language in which policy has been made. This is the discourse that suffuses newspaper editorials and has done for a long time. It's very difficult to switch overnight to a language of humility and to acknowledging that there are limits to American powers, just as there are limits to any kind of power, and that we cannot remake the world. So I suspect this sort of forms of thinking will linger for a while before, you know, it is overtaken by events, very fast-moving events in Arab world or in South China Seas, where, as I say, people who are not obliged to follow, or who no longer feel obliged to follow American demands or American desires, are reshaping their part of the world according to their specifications.
Coming from this American position of incredible power, hyperpower, and the self-esteem that goes with it, do you, Pankaj Mishra, foresee a graceful exit?
I don't, actually, because, you know, no empires, I can't think of any modern empire that has exited gracefully from the center stage of history. They've always been forced to acknowledge the limits of their power. And it's very rare that a country simply acknowledges that it has reached the end of what it can do, of its capacity, of its capability, and that they need to withdraw from the wider world. I think they are forced by events to do that, and that process is never a graceful one.
Pankaj Mishra, let's hope we learn to listen. Let's hope we learn something of humility. Thanks so much for this conversation, and thank you for your book, From the Ruins of Empire, The Intellectuals Who Remade Asia. Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with Pankaj Mishra over a Skype phone line to California. It takes energetic listeners to finish the job, with comments at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for being part of the project.